Today's episode of Vital Voices is brought to you by Oak Tree Medical Center.
Welcome to another episode of Vital Voices, where we bring you expert insights on health, wellness, and disease prevention. I'm your host, Alexis Burrows, and today we're diving into a crucial conversation about how the food we eat plays a powerful role in protecting our kidneys and colon. March is recognized as Nutrition Awareness Month, Kidney Awareness Month, and Colon Cancer Awareness Month. So what better time to explore how nutrition can be used to prevent and manage these conditions? Joining me today is registered dietitian nutritionist Shanishka Cambridge, an expert in medical nutrition therapy and disease prevention. She'll help us break down the biggest dietary risk factors, the best foods for kidney and colon health, and practical strategies for making healthier choices every day. So whether you're looking to take proactive steps for disease prevention, or you or a loved one is already managing kidney disease or colon cancer, this episode is packed with valuable insights you won't want to miss. So let's get started. Welcome back to the show, Shanishka. I think this is your third time on now. You're getting to be quite a regular around here. And I know our listeners have found the information very valuable and insightful. So we're happy to have you back on to talk about this very interesting and engaging topic.
Thank you, Mr. Burrows, for inviting me once again on Vital Voices. I'm happy to be here.
So as I mentioned in the intro, you know, March is recognized as Nutrition Awareness Month, Kidney Awareness Month, and Colon Cancer Awareness Month. And I think sometimes people don't always think about how nutrition plays a part in disease prevention, disease management, things like that. So, you know, how does what you eat, how you eat, intersect with kidney health and colon health, and I guess overall, like disease prevention and overall health? How does that fit?
That's a wonderful question. I'm happy to respond. As you would have said, March is Nutrition Awareness Month, and nutrition plays a fundamental role in chronic disease prevention. Mm-hmm. This is so fundamental that the evidence is being published in scientific journal articles like The Lancet, which tell us that an unhealthy diet is the leading causes of mortality and chronic disease development globally. So just from that fact alone, we can see that what we eat does have a major impact on whether or not we develop conditions such as chronic kidney disease and colon cancer. Mm-hmm. And as you would have mentioned, it is also Kidney Awareness Month. And the theme for this month is, are your kidneys okay? Detect early, protect kidney health. Mm-hmm. And so the message here is that we don't want to wait to find out that, hey, you have chronic kidney disease, you're about to go on dialysis, mm-hmm. or wow, you have stage 4 colon cancer. We should be implementing particular habits to get screenings early and on time so that we can reduce these risk factors. How does nutrition and colon cancer and kidney disease, what do they have in common? Well, what they have in common is that depending on our dietary patterns, and we'll talk about that, those patterns that increase oxidative stress and inflammation and excess acid in the system, they are all increasing the risk of colon cancer and chronic kidney disease. And so nutritional behaviors are very important in this conversation.
Okay, so let's first take a look, I guess a deeper dive into the role of nutrition in kidney health, right? You know, what are some of the primary causes of kidney disease, and how does nutrition play a role in its prevention? Because you already mentioned that, you know, nutrition is one of the top factors in the development of these chronic diseases. So, you know, kind of walk us through what that looks like.
Wonderful. So epidemiology statistics clearly shows us that one of the main causes of kidney disease or chronic kidney disease is diabetes and high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. We already know that it's a connection between what we eat in terms of our blood sugar and our blood pressure. So we see that link there. According to the National Kidney Foundation, in addition to diabetes and high blood pressure, other common risk factors for chronic kidney disease include having heart disease, mm-hmm. heart failure, being obese, having a history of smoking, having a family history of chronic kidney disease. And we do have some persons who have autoimmune conditions such as lupus, and so they are also at risk. So it is not caused by just one reason. Mm-hmm. So instead, it is a result of many interrelated factors. Some persons may have obesity and chronic kidney disease, or obesity and something else, or diabetes. And so early detection is key. And as we know, nutrition is impacting our blood sugar, our blood pressure, our weight, our heart disease profile. And so we can see how nutrition is playing a major role in prevention of these conditions.
Okay. So you mentioned that nutrition plays a role. And again, I think a lot of people may be unaware of like specifically how their diet and their dietary patterns affect their kidney function. So what are some of the biggest dietary culprits or even like mistakes that people make that may contribute to kidney disease?
If we are leading diets that are increasing our risk of high blood pressure and high blood sugar, this is going to have an impact. So these may include things, eating a highly processed diet, a diet that is rich in sodium or salt, rich in protein, simple sugars, sweeteners, sugary beverages, desserts, a diet rich in trans fats, shortening as an example, saturated fats, too much calories. These are some of the dietary culprits of kidney function. I want to just mention here right now the role of weight. I would have stated that one of the causes or primary causes or risk factors for chronic kidney disease is obesity. And sometimes we don't really think about it. We just say, oh yeah, you know, I have a little extra weight, you know, I could, you know, lose a few pounds, but is it really impacting my kidneys? And the answer is yes, because when our bodies have an excess size, the kidneys have to work harder. There's more blood that needs to be cleansed. There's more waste products that's being developed. And so obesity is also impacting our chronic disease profile. So therefore, if we're eating a diet that is leading to excess weight gain, that is also a dietary culprit of chronic kidney disease.
That's the thing, I guess, you know, we do sometimes tend to minimize, for a number of reasons, I imagine, our own mental health, thinking about it, like, you know, you don't want to consider yourself obese. But at the same time, like you said, the practical way in which our eating habits and, I guess, as a follow-up, our weight and things like that play into just the process, the physical process of how the body works and therefore puts it at risk. Looking at the other side of it, for people who may have already been diagnosed with chronic kidney disease, you know, how can they adjust their diet to potentially slow the progression of the disease?
When persons are told by their physician, the nephrologist, that they have chronic kidney disease, they need to find a dietitian right away, right? Working with a registered dietitian nutritionist or a board certified nutrition specialist is key. It is essential to help persons tailor the nutrition plan according to what they need. Patients have different diagnoses. Patients have different stages of chronic kidney disease. And as I mentioned this word stage, let me just say, you know, there are five stages in chronic kidney disease. And you may hear terms such as GFR, which stands for glomerular filtration rate. And a stage one means low risk. And a stage five means high risk. And so depending on where you are in terms of those stages, it would also differ what you need to be eating. So working with a dietitian is important. At that visit, the dietitian will be carrying you through a process called medical nutrition therapy, looking at not just your medical diagnoses, but what medications are you taking? What are your vital signs, blood pressure, blood sugar, your weight status? What are the labs saying? In addition to your diet history, to ensure that every little piece of the puzzle is being addressed so that when your nutrition plan is being developed, these things are ensured to have the correct attention. And of course, follow-up, monitoring, and evaluation by the registered dietitian nutritionist is very important. And this will help with normalizing some of the risk factors. In the Bahamas, we have plenty blood pressure, high blood pressure, plenty high blood sugar levels. Our weight status is continuing to rise. And so with these opportunities, working with the nutrition specialist, you'll be able to adjust your diet to address those, as well as reducing inflammation and acidity and oxidative stress, because these things can worsen kidney function. And so in terms of what else can be done, I mentioned the term acidity. some persons may say, oh, I'm trying to go drink some alkaline water. Drinking alkaline water is not the end all and be all of this conversation, but it's important for me to mention that we're alkaline because now we need to recognize the opposite of alkaline is acidic. Mm-hmm. And acid is something that destroys, that burns. And when we eat food, when our body metabolizes nutrients in general or just to live, acids are being produced. And so we can adjust the diet in such a way where we can lower the production of these acids. There's a term called potential renal acid load. And what it tells us is that if we're eating primarily plenty meat and poultry, fish, eggs, and cheese, and that is the major portion on our plate, mm-hmm. it's going to be reducing excess acids. These will damage the kidneys. And so working with a dietitian will help you to ensure you're getting enough protein, but not so much to the point where it's so acid forming, because this will be important to help with slowing down the progression. I will also mention right now protein, you know, because protein is something that we love to eat. When you ask a person what's for dinner, the first thing we're going to say is the meat. I having some chicken, but I ain't sure what else I gonna have with that, right?
Loving that chicken.
The concentration is on the protein, but when it comes to chronic kidney disease, you really want to be paying attention to that protein, because the protein based product is making the kidneys work the hardest. And so if our protein portion is too big, we're not on dialysis, we will be accelerating the progression of chronic kidney disease. So we need to pay attention to that, and also pay attention to that salt, that sodium, because the higher our sodium intake, the more the kidneys have to work, the more protein will be spilled in our urine, and that is an indicator that dialysis is imminent.
Because that explains why people with high blood pressure would be more, at a higher risk for kidney failure and kidney disease, because of the weakening of the blood vessels and everything in that space, all that ties together. So that's interesting. You know, you mentioned sodium, you mentioned protein. So what are some recommended foods for supporting kidney health? Because I imagine there's a certain need for protein in the body. So like, what are some ways that people can, you know, get the right foods in while still maintaining, you know, I guess the balance that they need to be able to function?
Okay, so as we approach meal planning for chronic kidney disease, we want to bear in mind some things. I would notice that oftentimes the concentration tends to be only talking about protein, talking about sodium, potassium, and phosphorus. For anybody who has chronic kidney disease or knows somebody with it, you may have heard some of these things. Oh, sodium, salt, potassium, phosphorus, protein. And while that is a part of the conversation, there's some other things, and I'll start with the other things first. A supportive diet for kidney health is going to be one that is anti-inflammatory, right? So anti-inflammatory means that it will be helping to reduce inflammation. So the question is, what is inflammation? Well, inflammation is a natural process that happens, a reaction when the body is exposed to something that can damage it, whether it be a chemical, a toxin, heat, whatever it is. And inflammation would occur naturally in the body because that's just what it is. But if there's too much inflammation, it promotes disease. Mm-hmm. And eating diets that are going to be high in processed foods is going to be associated with a diet that's high in inflammation. Eating diets that are going to be high in animal-based foods is also going to be associated with a diet of inflammation. So one or two ways of creating a meal planning system for a person who wants to support kidney health is trying to eat more whole foods. So whole foods are going to be those foods that are minimally processed. It looks like the original, they came from the farm. So if it was a fruit, it's not the juice or the fruit roll up, but it's the actual fruit. You know, if it's a vegetable, it's not the veggie chips, but it's the actual vegetable, and so go on and so forth. That helps with reducing inflammation in the body. I would have also mentioned the word acidity and alkaline forming. So we want to eat more fruits and vegetables and beans and nuts and whole grains, because these are going to help to reduce the inflammation in the body and help to reduce the production of acids. A supportive diet for kidney health is also going to be high in fiber. A lot of people don't know that fiber actually helps to nurture our good bacteria in our intestine. We'll talk more about that later, but how does it relate to the kidneys? It's because if we have unhealthy bacteria in excess in our bodies, those bacteria will produce more toxins. And these toxins have to be cleaned out by the kidneys and have to work harder. So, so far, supporting kidney health, anti-inflammatory foods, alkaline forming foods, foods that are high in fiber, foods that are high in antioxidants. And so some good sources are going to be cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower and kale. Fruits that have dark pigmented colors, particularly for kidney health. Things like the strawberries and the blueberries, our sea grapes, our cocoa plums, right? We can also include in there apples and fruit pears and plums. These things are important. And rather than getting too much of low fiber foods and to get more oatmeal and quinoa and whole grain products, that's also going to be helpful. Now, you would have mentioned about proteins. Well, we know protein is important, and we know that protein can come from things like meat and fish and chicken and poultry. But because we know that these things can produce more acids in the body, and eating a high intake of protein in chronic kidney disease before dialysis can accelerate the progression to kidney failure, you want to have smaller protein portion sizes from animals, and we want to include plant-based proteins as well. So these could be things like beans or peas or tofu. We can add the beans to a salad. You often see beans on the salad bar. We'll make the beans, add it to a soup, have a little bit of nuts with our cereal. These are different ways that we can include plant protein sources, so we don't have to overemphasize animal-based proteins. So I just said a lot. And so that's why working closely with a registered dietitian nutritionist is crucial when you have chronic kidney disease.
Okay. There's a lot jam-packed into that answer. I guess, you know, to just expand a little bit on, because I think sometimes people hear the term processed foods and they don't necessarily know, like, so what all would be considered. So obviously we understand lesser processes, it looks as close to its original form as possible. But I guess explain to people maybe some of the processed foods they should try to avoid so they have an understanding of, you know, the particulars. Because sometimes when we blanket it like that, people aren't necessarily able to understand, okay, so what should I be avoiding specifically?
Okay, so let's go with the food groups then. All right, so we have fruits. So a whole food form of fruit would be the actual fruit. So if you have
like an apple,
that's an apple. The processed version of the apple would be the apple juice. And so we would want to minimize perhaps the apple juice, especially if you have diabetes, because it will increase blood sugar. So let's go to a different food group, protein. One of the most problematic processed foods in terms of protein is processed meats. So when we talk about a meat or animal protein, they normally have a bone. So we see...
Oh, so you're talking about like the deli ham and
the
turkey.
The deli,
and
right.
Like that.
Right. So if we have the turkey came with a bone inside of it, but if now we turn that turkey into a processed deli meat turkey, now that is processed. And in the processing, certain chemicals were added. And some of these chemicals make it more difficult for the kidney to function properly or give it more work to do. And that what makes it more problematic. And they also may have extra salt inside of it.
Right.
Let's talk about maybe carbohydrates, starches, grains. So the original form of the grain might be like oatmeal, for example. But then we can go to the cereal aisle and we see many colorful, puffed up versions of cereal that look very different.
You walk in a very tight rope.
Look very different than the grain that you would boil in a pot on the stove. So that is processed. And when you work with patients with chronic kidney disease, you have to teach them how to read a food label. Because though it's ideal to say, we'll avoid things in the box, right? Avoid things in the can. Sometimes persons still would go to it because of whatever the reasons are. And reading those ingredient labels are important because we can identify things to avoid. So with phosphates, for example, might be in some of them, so we avoid those things. But, you know, if you don't go to the box, it's easier to avoid it. But that's some ways of finding out if it's processed. I talk about fruits, I talk about carbohydrates, I talk about proteins. So that's pretty much a good start because most of our food has those components.
It comes in those
in
categories,
it.
Right? Okay, so that's helpful because I think for me, like I know even when you talk about the like the plant-based proteins, what we found, like we've done, my wife and I and our family, from time to time, we've gone through periods of like whole food plant-based or you know whole food plant-based. Plant-based predominant, whereas like you may have meat once a week rather than, you know, every day or every other day. And what we found is even in that space, the difference between like a can of chickpeas versus like the bag of chickpeas that has no processing that you have to go through and do the soaking, or the same thing for like black beans, even those differences sometimes you find in the canning process, there's some extra stuff in there that even though it might take more time, you might be better suited to do the raw dry chickpeas and go through the processing yourself, or the black beans, go through that processing yourself, because it'll still be a little bit healthier than the canned version of it.
That's a wonderful point. And this is a conversation that I have with patients on a regular basis. Like as you would have said,
I think it's cheaper too. Yeah. I mean, it's more time involved, but from the cost perspective, I think it's less expensive to buy a bag of dry chickpeas or dry black beans than the processed canned version.
Mm-hmm. So how I would respond to that is just to emphasize what you just said. And one of the things you said, and our listeners are paying attention, is that you find benefit in intentionally emphasizing plant-based protein options as a way to promote good health. So the main thing is it helps. So beans is a good choice for protein, but as you would have stated, some beans are in the cans and some beans are in the bags. And yes, the ones in the bag is going to be healthier. You can soak them, mm-hmm. you cook them, maybe get a pressure pot to speed up the process. Mm-hmm. But if you find that you can find a way to do it, I would say to you, if you're going to use the can, rinse off the beans. A lot of times people buy the canned beans and they use the liquid because they say it adds flavor. But that flavor is what's going to have all the salt in it and some of the chemicals inside of it. But if we rinse that off, we can get rid of a significant amount of that.
That's interesting.
So that we can still utilize those beans. But I would still recommend using the canned beans and rinsing them off, then saying no beans and all, eat plenty of meat right. all the time, because then you're still going to not get that benefit.
Right.
But what we would want to do also with plant-based protein is ensure that we're getting closer to the original. Mm-hmm. So try not to get too much of the plant-based veggie dogs and the sausage and the bacon,
right.
because those are highly
also
processed.
Mm-hmm.
And they come with some risk as well.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, now you have to cross me, go home and ask my wife if that's why we just rinse off the beans, because we've always done it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was intentionally from her standpoint of trying to avoid the extras, or if that was just what we used to do. So now I got to go find out, because I know that's we've never used the liquid in the cans mm-hmm. of like the black beans or the chickpeas. It's always been rinsed. So now I got to go find out if that's why. So yeah, I think it's very helpful for people to kind of understand, even when you talk about, like you said, the veggie dogs and those sorts of things, the veggie patties, veggie chicken, like all this chicken with the apostrophe and all of these things, that sometimes you still have a lot of processing even in those spaces as well. I know another part of kidney function is hydration, so like water intake. How big of a role does hydration play in that? And then based on that, how much water should the average person drink? Because you hear 8 glasses, but like, what is the actual number? Does that change depending on, you know, if you already have disease, if you're in prevention mode, you know, is that based on age? Is that based on like weight, height? Like, how does that work?
Okay, good question. Hydration is an important topic in chronic kidney disease. Well, for one of the roles of the kidneys is to filter the blood, and the blood is primarily water. And so if we are not adequately hydrated, our blood will be more concentrated. It will cause the kidneys to work harder mm-hmm. and will cause more damage to the kidneys. So we want our blood to be at the right hydration status. Now, the question is how much? And you would have stated, does it differ depending on the stage you are at? And I would have said previously that there are different stages of chronic kidney disease. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't have chronic kidney disease, you want to be really hydrated well. Maybe you want to say, what is my weight? And divide it by 2, and that's the number of ounces. So if you're 160 pounds, then 160 divided by 2 is 80, so you want to be aiming for at minimum 80 ounces of water. Now, how would you know if that's enough? Well, you would know if when you go to the bathroom, your urine is not dark colored, it'll be a pale color, you maybe not see any color at all, you don't feel like you're thirsty, then that may be the correct amount of liquids for you. If you need more because you're exercising, you would go over that 80 ounces. So this is a person who does not have chronic kidney disease. However, if you do have chronic kidney disease and you're progressing along those stages, depending on where you are at and depending on your symptoms, if you have fluid retention, you may be advised to have a fluid restriction. And for some persons, that fluid restriction could be 32 ounces, which is not a lot. And this is a challenge for many patients with chronic kidney disease, especially those who are on dialysis, because they get thirsty. And it is true, they are thirsty. But because we know that consuming too much fluids at that point is going to be very problematic and increase the risk of complications, we have to coach and we have to counsel our patients to find ways of how do we manage this small amount. So if you're being told to drink a liter, which is 32 ounces, you might have to say, okay, with my first meal, I'm only going to have 8 ounces. And my second meal, 8, or third meal, 8, and somewhere in between, have another 8. But in between, what can I do? You know, maybe I need to chew on a sour candy or something like that. And we give you different tips and things to help manage that thirst. But fluids are very important. If you don't have chronic kidney disease, grab a bottle of water right now, drink up. Don't mind if you go to the bathroom, because going to the bathroom is a good sign. It means that your kidneys are working. Now, if you're not going to the bathroom and you're drinking the fluids, now that is a problem. And we don't want you to get to that point. But last thing I'll say about fluids is that it's not just about the liquids in the cup. You know, anything that you consume that turns into liquid has to be counted. So if you're eating ice cream, that turns into liquid, or Jello, that turns into liquid. Ice cubes, all of these things must be counted if you already have an advanced stage of chronic kidney disease. But if you don't, weigh yourself, divide your weight by 2, and aim for that amount of ounces in water.
Right, because you're right. You have water in like fruits and stuff like that as well. So it's a matter of being mindful of all everything that you take in that may have a liquid, or I guess turns into water, like you said. All right, so that's very good information on kidney.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI, top of the hill Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram movement continues. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring. Compassionate. Complete.
Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center, caring, compassionate, complete. Discover the ultimate in personalized healthcare with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your health needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 816-4-OPP, that's 816-4677, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus. Are you down with OPP? Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation.
Let's move our conversation then into, you know, the role of nutrition in colon cancer prevention. You know, from, you do a quick Google search on, you know, preventable cancers, and colon cancer is going to come up as one of the more preventable ones, based on things like early screening, lifestyle and dietary habits, things like that. So what dietary habits increase the risk of developing colon cancer?
As you would have stated, colon cancer is one of those cancers that has been labeled as preventable. There's a research study that I would have read in the Journal of Cancer Prevention that says at a minimum, at least 50% of the cases that we see could have been prevented through diet and lifestyle modification.
Oh, wow.
So now if we add early screening into that, that percentage is now even higher.
Mm-hmm.
So just by eating a healthy diet and having a healthy lifestyle, you are slashing your risk of colon cancer in half. Now, if you get your colonoscopy, now it even goes up higher. So we can see why it is being touted as being one of the most preventable types of cancer.
Yeah, you do the Google search and it says it's highly preventable.
Uh-huh, it's highly preventable, right? You know,
right.
Whatever number you want to put on that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same Journal of Cancer Prevention, they emphasize it's not just about thinking about what foods to avoid, but also thinking about how we're preparing the food. Now, I know some people, they could get upset today, but I only got to, you know, speak the truth and shame the devil, right? What is stated in this research article and in many sources is that if we are cooking foods at very high temperatures, mm-hmm. for a long period of time, especially over an open flame, it is producing what they call genotoxic agents. Genes, and toxic is a toxin. So these mm-hmm. are creating chemicals that are damaging our DNA. And it's the DNA in the genes that are giving the cells the instructions of what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So just for a little biochemistry, cancer means that your cells are growing and producing abnormally and an abnormal rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the instructions are saying, grow fast, create these tumors, clump together, that is not an instruction that you want to give your body. And
mm-hmm.
so what this is saying is that when we cook food at high temperatures for a long period of time, especially over a high flame, it produces more of that. And so this could be frying,
mm-hmm.
you know, broiling, barbecuing, even some types of grilling has been found to cause this risk. And so cancer centers like Stanford Medicine, they say if you want to reduce your risk of colon cancer, you should be eating less of the foods prepared that way. Also eat less of red meats and processed meats, fast foods and alcohol, because diets that are high in these things are linked to the development of colon cancer. I'm sure I'll talk more about that as we continue.
Yeah, and the frying is going to be a problem. It's just that I've had so many conversations now with different on different health issues and stuff like that. And when it comes to the conversation about food and food preparation, frying is basically like the devil at this point, right? But, you know, to go back, and I think you mentioned this in our conversation about kidney, you know, that fiber intake is also a part of the emphasis when people talk about colon cancer prevention. So how does fiber work in that process as it pertains to colon cancer?
Consuming a high fiber diet in general is a strategy for chronic disease prevention for a number of conditions. Obesity, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, cardiovascular, but also with colon cancer. So what is fiber? Fiber is that part of the plant that is not able to be digested by humans.
Mm-hmm.
We call it sometimes in our community the roughage.
Mm-hmm.
It is the part of the plant that gives it its shape. So when we look at a celery stands up tall and straight because of the fiber. Without the fiber, it would just be some liquid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that fiber is important. It helps with promoting good digestion. It helps with feeding the good bacteria in our intestines. It helps to remove the waste through our colon efficiently so we're not constipated. The fiber also helps to absorb these carcinogens. Carcinogens are the chemicals that cause cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So if perchance you're eating foods that may have some pesticides on it or what's not or other chemicals, if that meal is high in fiber naturally, it's going to be absorbing some of those chemicals so that when we stool, it goes into the sewer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so fiber is important for removing of the toxins from our intestine, supporting good, healthy gut bacteria. And we want the healthy bacteria to be supported because when they are healthy, less inflammation occurs, higher inflammation in the colon increases colon cancer risk. Less toxins are produced. Less toxins is reducing the risk of colon cancer. So good sources of fiber are going to be things like beans. Beans are very high in fiber. If you compare a cup of beans to a cup of lettuce, beans by far is going to trump the fiber. It's naturally high in fiber. Other sources of foods that have fiber would be your vegetables, your fruits, your whole grains, your unsalted nuts. But beans are like king in terms of a natural source of fiber. Of course, you know, you have fiber supplements, but it's not going to compare to getting the fiber from the actual food. And these are some of the sources we can get our fiber from in our diet.
This is the same thing, right? Like, it's natural. The fiber that you find in a bean is still going to be far more natural than whatever fiber is distilled down into some supplement or something like that. So I imagine it's kind of the same thing. It's if you get closer to the whole version of it, the better you are. I feel like we've kind of talked through the processed meats, you know, to a pretty good degree. I think the one question I would have here about where red meat and processed meat comes in is how much is too much? Because I know for some people, the concept of going completely whole food plant-based might just seem like such a foreign idea. So it's like, well, okay, if I wanted to try and do this, you know, how much is too much? Where would be the line of, okay, I, you know, can I have a steak like once a month? Can I, you know what I mean? Like that sort of thing. Because people would want to know from a practical level, I want to have my nice fat steak, but like, you know, can I have it once a month? Can I have it once a week? Can I have it every day with breakfast?
Good question. I know you want me to be quick here, but I'm going to say it quickly, right?
No, that's fine.
We need to really talk about this processed meat and red meat when it comes to colon cancer, because the World Health Organization says that processed meat is classified as a group 1 carcinogen.
Oh, boy.
A carcinogen means that it causes cancer. Group 1 means that it is sufficient evidence to show that it does cause cancer. So WHO is saying processed meats are giving is causing cancer, and
so
particularly colorectal. It's the highest level, the same level as smoking and asbestos. Fact check it on the internet.
Wow.
So in terms of how much processed meat, how much fire engine to eat, how much bacon, how much sausage and salami and corned beef, I would say zero, because we know that the scientists cannot run from it. This is causing cancer. When it comes to red meat, the evidence shows that every time you look at it, it says, okay, persons who eat a diet high in red meat and processed meats have a higher risk of colon cancer. So what WHO has said is that, okay, we can call this group 2A, not group 1. Maybe bring a little down low, because we're not sure. Maybe it was a little bias in that study. Maybe there was some confounding factors. Maybe it was just by chance, but it continues to come up over and over and over again.
It's so high.
But they say that, yeah, we can see that it's associated with cancer. And so my recommendation would be avoid processed meats, minimize red meats as much as possible. The lowest risk is none. But if you have it, you know, try to maybe once a week. It's up to you. But the evidence is that there's a link with
cancer. As little as possible.
And
if you could do none, do none.
Right.
But a fire engine, sorry, that one hurt. We used to have a fire engine every Saturday. That was like a tradition in my family. So it's like, but I get it. The idea is, you know, you have to think about how all these things play into your overall health. And maybe it's time to like make new traditions and do things in a different way. Okay, so let's move on. One of the other things I know when we talk about gut health, when we talk about colon health, colon cancer, all of this, is this concept of probiotics. So that is a word that, you know, for me for a long time, it's just a word I heard around the place. And I didn't quite have an understanding of it. So I imagine for a lot of our listeners, it's the same thing. You might not really know, like you hear it on commercials, you hear it, you know, you may hear physicians talk about it. You may hear your dietitian, nutritionist talk about it. But what role does probiotics play in gut health? And what are some of the ways that people can get probiotics in?
Okay, so naturally the body has good bacteria and so-called bad bacteria in our gut and our intestines. The good bacteria are referred to as probiotics. Pro means for biotic life, so it promotes good health. Yes, there are supplements where they put the probiotics in them, or they might put it in some yogurt or kefir or sauerkraut if it's a good quality source. But the real probiotics are already inside our body. And so we want to nurture that. We want to nurture that by eating foods that are going to be low in processed foods, low in sugar, low in fried foods, are going to be high in fiber, because we want to feed those probiotics. There's another word called prebiotics, P-R-E biotics. That is the food that the probiotics need to consume. You could be eating taking all of the supplements that you want for the probiotics, or you might be consuming kefir, yogurt as much as you want. But if you're not feeding those good bacteria, they will die. And so the prebiotics are going to come from the foods that are going to be high in fiber. Again, those beans and those whole grains, those nuts, seeds, and fruits and vegetables.
It always comes back to the beans and the nuts and the fruits and the vegetables. I mean, like I said, when you look at all of the conversations around how people can be healthier nowadays, that is such a big component of it. Like, I think, you know, it's helpful that we've moved more and more away from a generalized thing of, you know, just watch your intake and go exercise, to like, no, like, what do you specifically do in terms of making changes to your lifestyle? Because it'll always be like, you know, it's a lifestyle disease. It's diet and exercise. But I think the more that people are able to hear how they can actually manage and change, and what some of the substitutions are, the more helpful it is for them to kind of navigate, you know, and being able to prevent these diseases. You mentioned a little bit about like vitamins and supplements and things like that. Are there any specific ones that people should be aware of? I know from your position, your thing is always going to be get it as naturally as possible, right? So your fruits, your vegetables. But, you know, if there's a need for additional supplementation, what are some of the things that people might want to consider?
The topic of supplements and reducing the risk of colon cancer is very controversial.
Okay.
When you do the research, there were some persons that will say, take vitamin C, it can reduce risk. Others say, no risk, no benefit shown with vitamin C, or it can increase the risk. So what I would say when it comes to the supplements is that, generally speaking, things like vitamin C and omega-3 fatty acids, they tend to have beneficial impact in general. Vitamin C is an antioxidant, and so it's going to help with also reducing inflammation, and inflammation in the gut is a part of colon cancer progression. Omega-3 fatty acids, like such as fish oil, a good source, is also a good source for anti-inflammatory strategy, and so we can also include those. But of course, getting from the food is also important. But I will say, they have some supplements where they say they're grinding down the fruits and the vegetables, these super power foods. Perhaps something like that could also be included. So I would say those would be my top three, you know, the vitamin C, the omega-3 fatty acid supplements, and maybe getting the concentrated powder has the fruits and the vegetables and the superfoods in it.
And I think that you mentioned earlier, when it came to like the boxes and stuff, you read the labels just to make sure, like, there's not, because you have some supplements where there's all this fun and extra stuff in it that's not necessary, like that aren't necessarily good. So it's like the same thing there. You check the labels, you check the packaging to make sure that you're not getting an overabundance of things that are not like critical to the supplement itself. This last question in this section is going to be interesting, because culturally we have an issue with alcohol consumption. Generally speaking, Caribbeans just like to drink. And I got blanket. I ain't even going to say just Bahamians. Caribbean people in general, we have a tendency to overindulge in alcohol. But what are the risks? Like, what is the risk associated with alcohol consumption and colon health? And is there even a safe level of alcohol to intake?
Alcohol is a known risk factor for various cancers, including colon cancer. One of the reasons is because that it contributes to chronic inflammation in the digestive system, and inflammation is a key factor in the development of colon cancer. Alcohol also produces waste products. So when the body metabolizes alcohol, it produces things like, for example, acetaldehyde, and these compounds can damage the cells, damage the DNA, which gives the unfortunate instruction to produce cancer cells rapidly. Alcohol is not a nutrient that the body requires. It's not a vitamin, a mineral, it's not fiber, it's not protein. You know, it has no use. And so when we consume it, it is viewed as a toxin. But persons who think, well, I drink some wine because they say it's been beneficial, that is really being debunked. It wasn't the wine, it wasn't the alcohol, it was the grapes, right? It was the grapes that has the benefit in the wine. And so if you don't drink the alcohol, you're not going to be missing out on something essential. Boy. So that's just that. Persons who drink lots of alcohol, They may also have poor nutrition. They would want to drink alcohol rather than eat the healthy mm-hmm. foods, and that's mm-hmm. going to increase your risk further. And so what is a safe level of drinking of alcohol? Some cancer centers would say to you, well, if you could avoid it, avoid it. If you already have colon cancer, please avoid alcohol because you already have it. But there are some recommendations on how much to drink in a day. They may say 2 drinks for men or drink for women. Some cancer centers say just 1 in general, no matter who it is. But mm-hmm. what is a serving? A serving is 1.5 ounces of a hard liquor. Now mm-hmm. we know we're putting more than 1.5 ounces. Mm-hmm. That's like hardly nothing. That's like maybe a tablespoon or something like that. 2 tablespoons, right? Who's drinking 2 tablespoons of gin, right? And stopping, you know, or a 12-ounce beer, or, you know, 5 ounces, a half a cup of wine, and that's it. Right. You know, it's not much, but it's always best to minimize consumption of alcohol.
I remember we had this conversation, I think, with Dr. Carmen Cartwright. I think we were talking about hormones and stuff like that. And it was the same thing. She indicated, like, you know, like I remember the first time I learned that, like, the serving size, well, obviously the serving size differs depending on what it is. So it's different from beer to like clear rum to like dark rum and all these different things. It's all different. And the general idea was, we definitely don't, we way over consuming based mm-hmm. on what the actual serving size is, and when people say what the recommendations are for safe consumption.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI, top of the hill Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram movement continues. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center, caring, compassionate, complete.
Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center, caring, compassionate, complete. Discover the ultimate in personalized healthcare with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your health needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 816-4-OPP, that's 816-4677, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus. Are you down with OPP? Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation.
So, you know, we've kind of talked about it from the preventative standpoint, and I think we've touched a little bit on treatment and recovery. But, you know, now that we move specifically into that conversation, for someone who may have already been diagnosed with either kidney disease or colon cancer, how does nutrition factor into their overall treatment plan?
So as what I've stated previously, if you have a diagnosis of chronic kidney disease, hire a registered dietitian nutritionist right away, because mm-hmm. what you're consuming is having a direct impact on your kidney function and the progression of it. Some persons are able to slow it down. Some persons are able to improve it. Some persons are able to delay the onset of dialysis. So that is important. When it comes to colon cancer, similar things can be said. You may get the treatment to deal with the colon cancer medically, but we also want to prevent it from getting worse or coming mm-hmm. back. And so implementing the healthy nutritional habits definitely is important in your treatment plan away. So don't neglect nutrition when it comes to colon cancer, mm-hmm. prevention, management, treatment. Don't forget nutrition, and don't neglect it also for chronic kidney disease.
Okay. you know, I think a lot of times people may have misconceptions or there may be myths out there about how diet and nutrition factor into the management of conditions like this. What are some of those misconceptions and what would you say to them?
The biggest and the major misconception is that diet and nutrition plays a minor role in the prevention, the management, the treatment, and the recovery of chronic kidney disease or colon cancer. And that's the biggest misconception. We feel as if we hear about it, but, you know, that didn't really apply to me, or it's not even going to work, or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of faith in the medical treatment. And persons will have cookouts and they would get sponsorships, whatever they need to pay for that. We need to have the same motivation to pay for nutritional services, because the biggest misconception is that what I eat will not have a major impact on the result.
Mm-hmm. I mean, shameless plug, obviously, with Oak Tree being one of our primary sponsors, nutritional consults are something that comes with a lot of the options for their Oak Tree Primary Plus plan. So even with that, like, I think sometimes people may think about it like, well, I can't afford a nutritionist, right? But for things like that that exist, there's an opportunity then to have access to come and see you twice a year to at least, you know, get a plan started and get a follow-up to see how that plan is going. So there are things like that exist that help to kind of lower that potential barrier to entry for people. Many patients struggle with maintaining appetite and proper nutrition during cancer treatment. So like I know for my mom, and she was going through chemo, and she had breast cancer, but when she was going through chemo, her eating habits, like her appetite was all over the place. Like it was hardly ever a time where she was eating normally during that particular segment of time. Foods, what can help people to kind of manage that and make sure they're getting the proper nutrition? Because I imagine proper nutrition during a treatment cycle is very, very important. So how do people manage that properly?
Proper nutrition during cancer treatment is important. One reason we want to prevent malnutrition or the exacerbation of malnutrition. If a patient becomes excessively malnourished, their chances of survival lessens. And so, as you would say, appetite is often impacted. One of the first things you want to be asking the patients is, are there foods that make you feel worse? And so if there are foods that have odors that are offensive to you, you want to avoid that. So if you know that, for example, if I'm around sardine or if I'm around chicken, it could be something that you wouldn't even think would cause a reaction. You want to avoid that. So choosing foods that are mild in odors, mild in flavors, those things can be helpful. For some people, that may be something like bananas. You know, bananas. If banana is something you can tolerate, then you should utilize bananas. Also looking at having smaller meals, nutrient-dense meals. Maybe you might have to have a protein shake to get some extra protein there. Maybe add some little healthy fats to that some coconut milk or something to increase the calories. So different ways. So mild flavors, mild odors, smaller nutrient dense, add the protein, looking at options that you know that you can tolerate, and, you know, working with a dietitian to make sure that you're choosing foods that have the right nutrients, maybe get some supplements that can help with filling in the gaps.
Okay. You know, the medical space and the nutrition space is one that's been filled with this idea, this concept of superfoods. A lot in recent times. You know, I don't know what your take is on that in general, but, you know, are there any specific superfoods or even dietary patterns that have shown promise in supporting recovery and overall health?
When we think about a superfood, I think about a food that is known to show benefit in reducing risk factor of disease development and also improvement in recovery. Some of the things that we can talk about are things like antioxidants, right? So the colorful foods, so naturally colorful foods, whether it's red, it's purple, it's orange. So ensuring that we include them in our diet is important. So for example, orange, pumpkins are orange, carrots are orange, papayas are orange, red, you know, you might have like watermelon and strawberries, those are red. Purple, maybe things like blueberries and sea grapes and cocoa plum. Of course, we can't neglect white because white is important. Green is important, kale and and broccoli. Mm-hmm. Those things are also important. So having a colorful diet with whole foods is important in a plan that helps to promote and support recovery and overall health. And of course, make it be plant-based. So the majority of those foods, I said, or all of them, were plant-based options. And so we want to include those as well.
Okay. Another thing that's been a common phrase that we hear in this current iteration of life is meal planning and also mindful eating, this concept of mindfulness. So like my daughter tells me now, she's like, Daddy, because you know my wife has been studying lifestyle medicine and wellness and things like that. And so my daughter is right there alongside her. She's like, Daddy, you can't eat and be on the computer. You can't eat and watch TV because you're not mindfully eating. Because then you may eat more than you intend to, or you might not really like take it in and enjoy the moment. But you know, those two concepts, meal planning, mindful eating, how do they help patients who are managing these disease processes and trying to maintain their health while managing their condition?
Meal planning and mindful eating are very important. Patients can implement these strategies if they're educated. So once you're educated about the foods that we should be emphasizing, the foods we should be avoiding, we can sit down, get some practice with a registered dietitian nutritionist, and plan out those meals, and we can go shopping. So we don't want to just say, okay, I want to eat healthier, but then we need to have the food available. So if the food is not available to you, then you're not going to eat those healthy foods that you know that you should be eating.
Right.
So planning in advance is important so you can implement that. Now, mindful eating, like you would have said, has to do with your mindset. What environment are you eating in? Are you eating on the run? Are you driving your car and eating? Are you walking to the next meeting while you're eating food? Eating it in a state where you're not relaxed is going to produce more toxins, and because you're going to be under more stress, and more toxins is something we want to be minimizing when we are wanting to reduce the risk of colon cancer and chronic kidney disease, because there is an impact. So sit down, relax, concentrate, enjoy the food, and don't eat too much.
Y'all can't be coming for me like this, man. Like there was a segment of time in my life where eating in the car was such a, like lunch every day was it eating in the car from either one meeting to another or from, you know, some fast food place back to the office. I feel very seen. I'm trying to do better now, but you know, it is an interesting concept that I think people should really think on and take into account as they approach their health and their overall nutritional habits. So as we wrap, because I think this has been a very good conversation for our listeners, I think I like to give people, you know, some quick, hard recommendations. So from, you know, your role as a registered dietitian, nutritionist, if you could recommend three simple dietary changes for our listeners that they can start to make today to improve their kidney and colon health, what would they be?
You want to eat a high fiber diet. The high fiber is going to help to reduce your risk of colon cancer. Mm-hmm. It's also going to help to reduce factors related to chronic kidney disease development. So we're talking about things like beans, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. We also want to reduce our intake of simple sugars, sugary foods, consuming lots of Vitamalt and sodas and Kool-Aid and different snacks are high in sugar is going to damage our healthy bacteria, which can increase our risk of colon cancer, produce more toxins, and make it harder for the kidney to function. And then we want to reduce our intake of processed foods, primarily processed meats, because eating a high diet in processed meats is a risk factor for chronic kidney disease as well as colon cancer.
Awesome. You know, you've mentioned a lot throughout this conversation. One of the ways that people can really benefit is by engaging with a dietitian, nutritionist. You know, what does that process look like when somebody comes in to work through like a personalized nutrition plan? What does that relationship look like? How does that work for people?
The registered dietitian nutritionist will conduct a comprehensive assessment looking at your medical history. So questions will be asked about your medical diagnosis, the medications you're on, if you had any recent labs. It'll also look at your vital signs, your blood pressure, your blood sugar. There may be some measurements with your waist circumference in addition to your weight, maybe some body fat percentages, looking at your dietary habits. Mm-hmm. And all that information is collated in such a way to identify what are the main problems. What is the nutritional diagnosis? How can we create an intervention to address this and together and set up a plan for monitoring and follow-up. So it's a very comprehensive assessment, diagnosis, intervention, monitoring, and evaluation.
Awesome. So, you know, one final question, where can our listeners find, you know, more nutrition resources, and more specifically, how can they connect with you for more guidance?
It's important to get evidence-based information. So sources include places like the National Kidney Foundation for Kidneys, for Nutrition, Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and for cancer, the American Cancer Society. Of course, I am also available at Oak Tree Medical Center. I work there as the dietitian director. The number for me is 356-7091 or 825-4674. We're always available. As you would have said, Mr. Burrows, nutrition is included as one of the benefits in the OPP. And so sign up for OPP Plus today and you will be able to connect with me as a part of the benefits.
Awesome. So thank you again for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. This has been a very enlightening and informational episode, and I think our listeners will benefit greatly from it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, what an enlightening conversation. A huge thank you to Shanishka Cambridge for sharing her expertise on how nutrition can be a game changer when it comes to preventing and managing kidney disease and colon cancer. If there's one takeaway from today's discussion, it's that small, intentional changes in our diet can have a major impact on our long-term health. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to Vital Voices and share this episode with someone who might benefit from it. Thank you for tuning into Vital Voices, where we bring you the knowledge and tools to take control of your health. Until next time, stay informed, stay healthy, and take care. We'd like to give a special thank you to today's sponsor, Oak Tree Medical Center.
Did you miss a part of today's show? You can catch this episode and all Vital Voices episodes online at youtube.com/@VitalVoices242. See you next week as we sit down with another Vital Voice.